From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caritti, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, December 1st, 2016. And on this day, Portland landlord Gregory Nisbet is sentenced to 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine in connection with a fire that killed six young adults 2 years ago. Maine lawmakers on both sides of the aisle propose a bill that aims to increase testing of private wells for the dangerous chemical arsenic. And solar power advocates urge Maine utility regulators and lawmakers to preserve so-called net metering. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
I'm Barbara Caritti. Portland landlord Gregory Nisbet got a 3-month jail sentence today and was ordered to pay a $1,000 fine in connection with a fire 2 years ago that killed six young people. Fred Bever was in the courtroom and has this report.
Last month, Superior Court Justice Thomas Warren found Nisbet not guilty of manslaughter, but Warren ruled that Nisbet was guilty of a misdemeanor code violation for failing to provide an adequate emergency escape route on the building's renovated third floor, even though he'd been warned about how small the windows there were. Three of the tragedy's six victims died on that floor, unable to escape the fast-moving fire that roared up the stairs early in the morning after Halloween. At the sentencing hearing, the mother of one of those victims, Lisa Mazziotti, took the stand to remember her daughter Nikki, who was 29 years old when she died.
The loss of a child is the worst kind of grief that anyone can ever go through. I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy.
She recalled her agony as she waited 7 days for her daughter's body to be identified and her amazement at learning that Nisbet played a game of tennis after learning about the fire.
I'll never understand how a landlord could play tennis while their apartment house is burning and not even know if their tenants made it out okay. I have so much anger towards someone who has taken no responsibility or shown any remorse.
Mazziotti and prosecutors called for the maximum penalty, 180 days in jail. They argued that in addition to punishment, it would send a clear message to the state's landlords. But Nisbet's lawyer, Matthew Nichols, argued that the message has already gone out and that Nisbet's code violation, two small windows on the top floors, could be found on countless 20th century buildings in Portland and beyond. Jail time, he said, would be unprecedented.
This is a no-jail case, Your Honor. When you add in all the mitigating factors and the absence of a single solitary aggravating factor, you're down to zero jail time.
And while at trial, Nisbet declined to take the stand in his defense, he did in the sentencing hearing. He apologized and told the court he took responsibility for his actions and inactions.
I can only imagine the pain and the hell that you go through every single day.
Thank you, because I forgot.
I myself cry and mourn daily the loss of those young lives, mourn for their parents and children, for their friends, for their loved ones.
Justice Warren brushed aside some of the arguments made by each side, saying that just because other buildings may not be up to code, it does not reduce the severity of the offense when lives are actually lost. But he also said that Nisbet's game of tennis that day was not necessarily a sign of inhumanity, and he accepted Nisbet's words of apology. He chose a 90-day jail sentence and a $1,000 fine. After the sentence, victims' family members seemed subdued and somewhat resigned. Ashley Summers, whose husband Stephen died in the fire, says she appreciated Nisbet's apparent remorse to a degree.
It was a good statement. It's hard for me to disregard the facts that came out throughout, you know? So the negligence beforehand is what led to him kind of feeling bad later. So, you know, so it's just tougher.
Summers says her two children are only beginning to accept their father's death. Nisbet has 21 days to appeal his sentence. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Meanwhile, a bipartisan group of legislators has introduced a measure that aims to bolster the rate of arsenic testing in the tens of thousands of private wells across Maine. Mal Leary reports.
Citing several studies about the adverse health impacts of arsenic in well water, a group of lawmakers has introduced legislation that would bolster testing efforts by creating a fund to support outreach and improve testing rates. Federal studies indicate that less than half of the state's households that rely on well water test for arsenic. At a State House news conference, lawmakers argued the state needs to do more to educate well owners and achieve a statewide goal of 65% testing by 2020. A similar bill was vetoed 2 years ago by Governor Paul LePage, and supporters are hopeful they will have enough support this session to pass the bill over the governor's objections. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And backers of solar power today fired a preemptive shot in the latest battle over so-called net metering. That's the practice of having utilities pay retail prices for excess power purchased from solar panel owners. Andrew LaVogue of Environment Maine said there's a network of fossil fuel and utility-backed organizations that are campaigning against the spread of solar power.
Pollution-free solar energy represents one of Maine's most abundant energy sources for our climate and for our economy. We can't allow special interest forces in the fossil fuel industry to pull the plug on the bright potential of solar power.
LaVogue and other speakers at a Portland news conference said they expect Governor Paul LePage's public utilities commissioners to issue a ruling against net metering any day now. Harold McWilliams of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Portland told reporters that the church has put on hold a $70,000 solar power investment because it can no longer be sure that the finances will work.
A few years ago, things were very clear, and then legislation was proposed that would have satisfied the needs of many, many stakeholders and changed the situation a little bit, but at least it would have been a steady situation. Now we don't know what's going to happen with solar in Maine.
The legislation McWilliams mentioned passed the legislature but was vetoed by Governor LePage. Glenn Brand of the Sierra Club's Maine chapter says the group is ready to go back to the legislature to defend the right to generate their own power and be compensated for the power they feed into the electric grid. And the University of New England and Apothecary by Design have teamed up to offer a residency program in specialty pharmacy. UNE pharmacy professor Dr. Kenneth McCall says the residency will give pharmacists hands-on training on how to care for patients with conditions such as organ transplantation, hepatitis C, and rheumatoid arthritis.
It's needed particularly because we have more chronic, complex medical conditions demographically as the country is older.
The specialty pharmacy residency will launch in July. It's estimated that fewer than a dozen such residencies exist in the U.S. Coming up, what led to Donald Trump's victory in the presidential race, and what does it mean for Maine? Down in Washington, a bill supported by Maine's U.S. senators that aims to strengthen security at the nation's northern border has unanimously passed the U.S. House. Senator Susan Collins, a Republican, and Angus King, an independent, co-sponsored the Northern Border Security Review Act, which passed the U.S. Senate last month. It passed the House late Tuesday. The senators say the bill would require the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to evaluate security threats at the border by conducting a comprehensive examination of the resources and personnel levels. The bill now heads to President Barack Obama's desk. At 5,500 miles long, the U.S.-Canadian border is the world's longest common land border and has 120 border crossings. The senators say about 300,000 people cross the northern border every day. And Senators Collins and King announced today that two tribes in northern Maine will share more than $200,000 in USDA funds. The Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaqs and the Holton Band of Maliseets will use the funding to develop economic and business opportunities for tribal members. The Mi'kmaqs plan to use some of the funds to study the feasibility of developing specialty food products and renewable energy on some 3,000 acres of land it owns. The Maliseets plan to make business loans available to tribal members. And the USS Zumwalt has resumed its journey to its new home port of San Diego. The Bath Iron Works-built ship was headed that way last month when it broke down in the Panama Canal. Authorities say the ship left Panama yesterday after repair crews fixed the problems that caused the breakdown. USS Zumwalt crew members and a repair team from General Electric and Naval Sea Systems Command made repairs to the ship's propulsion system. The repairs have been tested and evaluated, officials say, and the ship is once again on its way to San Diego. And President-elect Donald Trump has said he'll propose a huge trillion-dollar 10-year infrastructure plan in his first 100 days in office to improve the nation's transportation system. Maine's Transportation Commissioner David Bernhardt, who has just been elected president of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, will be in the middle of the discussions.
So the question will be is where does that funding come from? Is it funding or is it financing? So those are the questions that we're asking that haven't been answered yet.
Congress has traditionally opposed increased fuel taxes to pay for roads and bridges. So Bernhardt says how Trump resolves the funding question will be important to states like Maine. He says the scope of the proposal has the potential to address a lot of the state's needs. And Donald Trump's victory in the presidential race has some cheering, some choking, and some just scratching their heads, wondering how did this happen? Keith Shortall turns to our roundtable of across-the-aisle analysts for some answers. This week, they include Dick Woodbury, an economist who served in the legislature as an independent, Meredith Strang Burgess of Burgess Advertising, a former Republican lawmaker, and Cynthia Dill, an attorney who served in the legislature as a Democrat.
Dick, Meredith, Cynthia, happy Thursday. We haven't had much of a chance to talk about what happened on November 8th and what it means. But now that we've had a few weeks to step back and look at the implications of the pending Trump administration, Meredith, how will things change going forward?
Well, I think they're going to change quite a bit. You know, even if it's not draining the swamp, as perhaps the rhetoric was before the election, certainly the swamp is being rearranged. And I think people really just want to change. And there needs to be some moment where on both sides of the conversation and at both ends of the spectrum, people just stop the rhetoric of accusatory back and forth and go, okay, we've spoken and people want to change. We're going to have change. And then we can react to the specific parts and pieces. And we should all remember that it's in all of our best interests that the Trump administration be as successful as possible.
Dick, now that you've had a few weeks, what are your impressions of what happened?
Well, I think this is a case where you knew to some degree that all of the theatrics of the campaign were not the exact person you were going to get when Donald Trump was elected. So I think there was a lot of uncertainty and unpredictability about what exactly his policy positions were going to be, what sorts of people he would bring in to advise him and be in charge of agencies and so forth. And we're beginning to see that play out. We're seeing, you know, we're obviously seeing the appointments that he's making. We're seeing him hinting at policy positions that are less extreme, if you will, than the ones that he talked about on the campaign trail. It's certainly a different style. We get a lot of news from tweets as opposed to press conferences, and they seem to come from him almost more spontaneously than having been thought out. What do I want to say in a formal press conference or a press release? So it's a different kind of presidency, and it was not my choice. But we're seeing it play out.
Cynthia, you were, as we know, a Clinton activist. How do you feel about going forward?
Democrats sort of fall into a couple of different camps. I mean, some people want to wait and see and give Donald Trump a chance. I think I sort of, for the most part, I'm in that camp. Others feel the need to protest immediately some of his cabinet picks. The Bannon guy from Breitbart News, for example, making, I think, very fair accusations that instead of draining the swamp, he's just restocking the swamp. And, people who wanted a change agent, well, we're seeing, yeah, we do have a change agent. We have a erratic president-elect who apparently can't control himself in the middle of the night with his Twitter account, choosing, hopefully, good candidates. I, for one, hope Mitt Romney is the Secretary of State. Now, if you'd asked me 4 years ago if I would ever be saying that on radio, I probably wouldn't be. But I'm praying every night that Mitt Romney is our Secretary of State. So things clearly have changed.
Now, a lot of people missed a lot of the cues going on here, the forces that led to this outcome. Some would say the Democratic Party, Cynthia, maybe wasn't paying enough attention to that bloc who went for Obama 4 years ago, but haven't seen enough change, positive change in their life, and went for Trump this time. How do the Democrats get those people back?
Well, I mean, those people, if what they want was just a change agent with absolutely no regard to any policy behind the rhetoric or any track record or any professional experience, I don't know how you run against that. I mean, I think the Clinton campaign did an admirable job running a candidate with a long track record of public service, accomplishments in public policy. She won a majority of the popular vote. I think the Clinton campaign did a good job for the most part. Did they fall short? Of course they did. In a two-way contest, somebody always loses. I don't think, like the Super Bowl, if you make it to the Super Bowl and you lose by a couple points, it doesn't mean you're a loser. It doesn't mean necessarily that you failed. Some things are out of your control. I think the economic message has to be made by Democrats, because what now is the memes and the rhetoric is that somehow there's identity politics, that all Democrats talk about are gays and, transgender bathroom issues and women and minorities. But obviously, those groups are talked about because of economic issues. They are discriminated against on an economic basis, and that's why they have a special voice, and that's why the Democrats tend to include them under the tent. It's not because we're not Christian. It's because that's what the Christian thing to do is for most Democrats. It's not because we don't care about economics. It's because women, minorities, and others are often disadvantaged economically in the current environment. So we just need to, I think, make it a clear connection between who we stand for and the economic interests at stake.
On the Republican side, Meredith, this populist movement behind Trump has kind of alienated even many Republicans, as we know. What's the future then of the identity of the Republican Party?
Great question, and stay tuned. I, too, would like to see a Mitt Romney chosen to be part of the cabinet. And I'm looking for Trump to build a real diverse group, and I think it's going to be okay.
Dick, as an economist and a former politician, did both parties, do you think, here in retrospect, are they both guilty of just kind of telling these displaced, struggling former mill workers, hey, look, we're not going back to the manufacturing era. You're going to have to retrain yourselves. The jobs aren't coming back. It's a global economy. Get used to it.
I think you're right. I think both sides moved to a much more protectionist, non-free trade place in their policies in a way that's really contrary to an economy that has become globally interdependent, where, sure, we care about the workers in our country that may be displaced by some aspects of global trade, but we also care greatly about the workers in this country and the businesses in this country that exist and are thriving and growing because they're able to sell their products in a global marketplace. And, granted, that's the two sides of trade, but when it's working, it is to the benefit of of both sides, to all sides that are participating in trade. So I think that this, on the Republican side, a move to much more extreme nationalism, but really on both sides where there's been a move toward potentially more protectionist policies, it's a step back in how we need to think about our participation in the global economy.
All right. Cynthia, Dick, Meredith, we'll see you next week.
And that was Keith Shortall talking with our roundtable of analysts, Republican Meredith Strang Burgess, Democrat Cynthia Dill, and Independent Dick Woodbury. Across the Aisle airs every Thursday on Maine Public Radio and online at mainepublic.org. And a winter storm warning remains in effect for much of northern Maine until 7 o'clock this evening. Some areas could be digging out from 14 inches of snow or more when it's all over. It's been a sloppy mix with freezing rain farther down the state and strong gusty winds down east. That's created some work for electric utilities from Madawaska to the Cranberry Isles. At this hour, some 2,300 customers, most of them in Aroostook County, are still without power. That's down from an outage peak of more than 2,600. And here to tell us what's in store for the coming days is meteorologist Paul Cousins.
Throughout the southern half of Maine, the first day of December resembled the first of May, while residents from Millinocket to Madawaska had a solid slab of wintry weather. The last storm for many days has now vacated the state. Across northern Maine and the mountains, showers of rain and snow will be winding down. Expect clearing for the remainder of the state, 28 north to 36 along the coast. Tomorrow, still mild and breezy. Snow showers will be confined to the Quebec border with minor accumulations. Limited sunshine throughout the remainder of Maine, 34 to 50 north to south. Northwest winds will freshen this weekend and will deliver somewhat more seasonable temperatures. Saturday, mostly cloudy north and mountains with snow showers. Partly sunny throughout the remainder of the state, 30 to 45 north to south. Sunday, mostly sunny for all and breezy, mid-20s north to near 40 south. Monday and Tuesday, tranquil, cool, and bright, with light snow possible across southern Maine Wednesday. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, December 1st, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Fred Bever, Mal Leary, Erwin Gratz, Patty White, Jennifer Mitchell, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.